very much. It's a great pleasure to be here this evening. I'm going on first because I must confess I know nothing of Islam, but I do know a little about atheism, and that's going to be the subject of my talk this evening. I think my challenge is to convert you all, but I somehow feel within me that that's going to be a slightly uphill task, but I'll do my best. Now, I claim that science is the only way to understand the fundamentals of the world. That includes understanding its physical structure and origin, the action and events that pervade the world, and the attitudes and principles that govern human behaviour. I'd even go so far as to claim that science can provide an understanding of aesthetic appreciation and religious belief. Now, it may be discomforting for you, but I also believe that modern science provides evidence that can be assembled into an argument that disproves the existence of God. Now, these are strongish claims, and they hit at the very foundations of religious belief, and some would say the structure and stability of societies. Now, clearly I need to present some kind of argument to support them. And my argument may offend some and be seen by others to be a manifestation of a cardinal sin of pride. I'm here, though, at your invitation to present my honest thoughts. And I can present them either obscured or plain, without obfuscation. And I've chosen the latter in the hope that it will stimulate debate. I apologize in advance if, in fact, I do offend. My purpose is not to offend, but to contribute to the pursuit of truth. First, I'll deal with the scientific and religious methods of exploration of this universe. As far as I can see, that there's only one point of similarity between science and religion. They both claim to search for truth. However, their methods for implementing the search could hardly be more different. Religion is a private pursuit of truth, driven by internal revelation and guided by authority. Religion is largely a culturally conditioned journey of sentimental wishful thinking. Not the least of the evidence for this view is the fact that the religion that a person adopts is commonly that of his parents and the community in which he's grown. If there were one true religion, it would be universal, not needing to be made universal by warfare, battle, and conquest, but simply become universal by joyful acceptance. Religious belief is imposed on individuals by the cultural milieu of their environment, by the social practices of their families and communities. In contrast, science is a public pursuit of truth. It's guided by publicly executed experiments under controlled conditions. Science is transnational and transcultural. It's certainly the case that science has grown from Eastern roots that came forth in Babylon and Arabia, flowing into Western consciousness mainly through Greece, Italy, and Spain. It's also the case that the dominant growth of modern science has taken place in Europe and North America. Nevertheless, science is far grander than this localization of contribution might suggest. Science is successful regardless of the cultural background of its users. An idea may emerge in Japan and be incorporated into an activity in Malawi. Data from Kazakhstan may be essential to work going on in Peru. I know that people sometimes say that there should be a peculiarly Islamic science, so that more of the Eastern tradition should be blended into science, just as some say that there should be a feminist science to displace what is perceived by some as its predominantly male component. I think that's all dangerous nonsense. Of course, there should be local interests in science, such as the study of indigenous herbal medicines, but science is so successful in its current mode, there is not the slightest need to contaminate its procedures by ideals driven by politics. Indeed, if this planet requires anything, it's the universality of the pursuit and achievement, not sectionalization. Science is currently gloriously successful through its internationalism and its transculturalism, and as such, it is a beacon of achievement for humanity. Now, religion is based on authority. Science seeks to overthrow authority and is contemptuous of claims of perfection. Religion encourages conformity, because that is the better way to achieve control. And as I shall comment on further, control is the central aim of institutionalized religion. Science encourages conformity too, but it encourages conformity of procedure, not conformity of belief. It assumes that controlled experimentation, allied with the strict regime of mathematical formulation and peer review, has brought it to its currently preeminent position as a mode of elucidating and understanding. But that is the extent of its respect for authority. Scientific research is a ceaseless search for flaws in purported authority and for the overthrow of the past. Look at the extraordinary revelations about the nature of the physical world that stem from Newton's overthrowing of Aristotle, from Einstein's overthrowing of Newton, and of Heisenberg's and Schrödinger's overthrowing of the lot of them. If science had held that belief in authority is essential, then science would be stuck in the past, if I may add, like religion is today. Let me say a few words about the domain of elucidation open to science. There's another really dimension, I suppose, and the difference between religion and science. Religion has contempt for the power of human understanding. It asserts that we are simply intellectually too puny to understand the deep questions of existence. Religion claims to hold the keys to the elucidation of our role in the universe, to the spiritual dimensions of our life, to human deportment, to human enjoyment. It claims in its various manifestations to offer solace, purpose, and some kind of reason. Religion then asserts that that is its domain, and science has nothing to add. It goes on to say that whereas we humans may struggle to understand the mind of God and comprehend his works, we are intellectually incompetent to do so. True understanding will come only with death and incorporation, for the lucky ones at least, in some kind of paradise. Thus it is that religion is contemptuous of humanity, for it supposes that there is a limit to man's understanding of his condition. Science, on the other hand, respects the human condition. It shows that the human mind is such a powerful instrument of discovery that it appears to be capable of complete understanding. How ironical it is that religion, which purports to be the spiritual ally of humanity, denigrates its potential, whereas science, which opponents claim cannot tread in the spiritual dimension, respects, encourages, and exposes the awesome power of human comprehension. Science is unsurpassed. I think I can be confident that everyone here agrees in its ability to deal with the physical world, to make predictions, not all of them right, to build aircraft, to build televisions, to unravel the biophysical and biochemical foundations and intricacies of life. I'd like to claim that it is also unsurpassable in its ability to provide answers to the great questions of being, such as our cosmic origin, the origin of the cosmos, our purpose, and our future. It can also elucidate, I believe, the distinction between right and wrong. Indeed, in my view, there is nothing that science cannot elucidate in a manner, this is most important, that is open to human comprehension. Which means, of course, comprehension this side of the grave. I want to say a few words about the contribution that religion and science have made to our comprehension of the human condition. I'll deal with our origin, our behaviour, and our future. Religion has contributed nothing to our understanding of the origin of the universe. The assertion that God made it contributes nothing to our understanding, other than the false impression that it is an explanation. It has admittedly inspired some quite neat art. All religious explanations are myths, driven by the urge to fill the vacuum of understanding. Science too cannot explain yet the origin of the universe, but it's edging forward into the past and uncovering the clues that will lead to a full understanding. Look how far we've come in 100 years of scientific effort. In contrast, I might add, to the total lack of progress after the several thousand years of religious effort. The 20th century has seen the discovery that the universe is expanding. It's funny that that's not mentioned, as far as I know, in any religious book. The confirmation of the Big Bang, the beginning of the universe, and the formulation of theories that take us back to almost a trillion, trillion, trillionth of a second of that inception. All that has been achieved in less than 100 years. Currently, I admit, we're a bit stuck. But scientists are quite clear about what they have to do to achieve progress and push that trillion, trillion, trillionth of a second down to zero. The beauty of this enormous intellectual achievement is that it is open to inspection, it's not a private mystery, and it has been achieved without the intervention of a god. Now, once the universe exists, then it's not in the least surprising that planetary systems form and in due course become through the awesome, purposeless, unconscious power of natural selection, populated by organisms that can reflect on their own origin. Contrary to religious texts, there is no evidence of design. In fact, the evidence gathered by science is contrary to there being design, particularly in the realm of evolution. The religious texts that claim design as the origin of the biosphere are just plain wrong. Well, I suppose some might claim that to have anticipated at least some aspects of what science is establishing, but they're able to do so only because they expressed so ambiguously or so obscurely that their content can be stretched at will. Now, the uncreated, undesigned, but evolved creatures that constitute mankind need to behave within the societies that have emerged. Religion lays down rules, sometimes general, sometimes specific. While that may result in social stability and cohesion, it's intrinsically repressive, as it cannot respond to the changing norms and aspirations of humanity. How much better it is to see the distinction between good and evil as rooted in our own physical and mental makeup. That is, how much better it is to see the origins of socially acceptable behaviour as springing from our evolutionary past. Science can elucidate the origins of acceptable behaviour, commonly by seeing the forces of survival at work, but also identifying our peculiar mental ability to contemplate the consequences of our actions. How much better it is to understand ourselves than to find ourselves in the grip of often outdated authority. Science can elucidate our cosmic purpose. The religious view may be that man has been created in service and obedience to God's will, or as an active participant in creation. Now, Let's ignore, for the moment, the intellectually impoverished view that man has been made and concentrate on his purpose. In my view, science eliminates purpose. Science exposes the fallacy of the view that there is a purpose. In part, it does so by showing that all events in the universe are the outcome of the purposeless workings of the second law of thermodynamics. I consider that the second law is the great liberator of the human spirit. I'm not going to go into it now. For it shows that we are the creatures of the purposeless unwinding of the universe. Purpose is in fact a theological invention proposed by those who, having started from the view that there is a God, must presume that he had a purpose in making the universe. In my view, that is backward thinking. Accept that there is no purpose, and accept that we are extraordinary accidents of nature, thereby feel refreshingly clear about our cosmic contribution. Let me turn to the relative evils of science and religion. Science is knowledge. Knowledge in itself is neutral. It is neither good nor evil. The application of science may be for good or evil. Science certainly provides more ways of killing people and other organisms, but it has never encouraged murder. Knowledge is ethically neutral. I also consider greater knowledge to be better than less knowledge. I can think of no reason why ignorance should be a better foundation for action than knowledge. Religion, on the other hand, I'm afraid has blood on its hands. It's the complement of science, in the sense that whereas it does not provide means of maiming and murdering, it certainly has encouraged maiming and murdering. Once again, we're confronted with the irony that icy-hearted science has never waged war, but human spirit-enhancing religion has been and continues to be directly responsible for countless deaths. Religion also maims lives. By appealing to outworn authority and failing to adjust to evolving societies, it inhibits personal aspiration, particularly of women, but not only of them. Any religion that falsely promises a better future after death is intrinsically evil, for not only does it give false hope, which is, I must admit, not in every case a bad thing, but especially because it intrudes into this, our one and only life, and in many cases represses achievement and happiness. It's intrinsically evil, I consider, to lead people to restrict their lives in order that they may enjoy paradise. There is no paradise beyond death. Science, in fact, just good old plain common sense, in fact, shows that life cannot persist in any form after death. Supposing that it does is good old plain wishful thinking. The institutionalization of the false hope that there is an afterlife or a day of judgment is repressive of humanity and should be discarded before it does even more damage. How long have I got?
About 2 minutes.
I have 2 minutes, I'm afraid, for the non-existence of God. I consider that it's possible at least to assemble evidence from science in its broader sense, that argues convincingly that there is no God. Of course, I might be wrong. The world may indeed be an elaborate illusion created a few moments ago. Now, there are two prongs to my argument. First, science shows that there is no aspect of the physical world that requires divine intervention for it to be brought about. We don't need God for the creation. We don't need God for the operation of physical laws. We don't need God for the emergence of conscious creatures. And we don't need God to accommodate the purpose of the world, for it has no purpose. Nor do we need God as a foundation of right or wrong, for the foundations of behaviour are our evolutionary history, in combination with our intellectual power to consider consequences. The second prong to my argument is that there is a compelling need to believe, The world is a complex, often harsh, and difficult place. Much of the world lives on the edge of pain and misery. It's hardly surprising that people long for a reward, long for immortality, long for a reward for the misery of self-denial in this world, and hope, indeed, for punishment of those who've crossed them or harmed them. Of course people long for something beyond the physical world, and they're confirmed in this belief by the authority of their religious leaders, whatever their faith. How can the underinformed escape from this extraordinarily potent combination of longing and imposition? Of course they can't, unless they approach the world with an open mind. But how terrifying that is. In short, a God is unnecessary for accounting for any aspect of existence, for people long for the comfort of a super being. I consider that those two aspects point inescapably to the non-existence of a God, particularly when allied to the fact that there is no evidence in favour of there being one. I have to conclude that science is a glorious achievement of the human intellect. It grew out of religion and should be regarded as surpassing it and replacing it as a means of understanding the nature of the world. It is only the institutionalization of sentiment and fear and an inclination to accept easy answers rather than do the hard work demanded by science that keeps religion alive. Religions provide meaningless but culturally localized answers in terms of an unknowable complexity. Science provides meaningful answers that transcend cultures in terms of a knowable simplicity. Of the two pursuits after truth, only science respects the power and wonder of the human intellect, and I commend it to you as the path to truth. Thank you.
Argue for four propositions tonight. One, that science does not support atheism, but on the contrary would support belief in a God. Two, we need both science and religion. Science and religion are two ways of looking at life, and we need both in order to have a more holistic approach. Three, that the history of tension and conflict between science and religion were focused on a number of points which we will find to be alien to the religion of Islam. And four, I would like to show that there is a harmony between Islam on the one hand and science on the other hand, thus making it possible for young thinking university students and university professors to believe in God even in the modern times. Well, let's go to the first proposition then. I'd like to show that science does not support atheism, but rather it would support a belief in God. First, science cannot deny the existence of God. The scientific method rigorously applied has to deal with things which are observable. And by definition, God is not observable. Hence, science has no way of disproving the existence of God. The most one can do is to say, well, we know why people believed in God. We can retrace in history that people, perhaps out of fear, perhaps out of their upbringing, they believed in God. But let's take these points one at a time. Is it right to say that because people might have believed through fear, therefore God doesn't exist? In fact, even if people believed it for the wrong reason, God may still exist. So proving the reason to be not a good one does not disprove the contention itself. Otherwise, we fall into what is called the genetic fallacy, explaining the truth or falsity of an idea based on the origin of the idea. That doesn't work. Second, one may say, well, it is because of your upbringing. Again, that is committing the genetic fallacy. In fact, you may say that those who say that we believe in religion because of our upbringing may be saying that because of their upbringing. But we wouldn't do that because that would commit the genetic fallacy. Moreover, scientists may want to argue for their atheism by saying that we can explain scientifically how things work. And since we can explain how things work, we do not need to invoke a god for how things work. Well, in Islam, the way we see this is that the way things work does not exclude the possibility of a creator. In fact, the Quran, without embarrassment, describes how the rain comes. But yet the Quran gives credit to a god who made it possible for rain to come through the process that scientists might be able to elucidate even further. The Quran describes how babies are born in infinite detail, and yet the Quran gives credit for that to God. The Quran, on the one hand, does not try to show that the things which are human beings are unable to understand are the things which are creditable to God. But the Quran is making it plain that even the things which you can understand and appreciate and you can explain still need a God. And so we should now turn then to the proofs which would show that there is a God, even for scientists. Now, when we ask, first of all, where do things come from? Why do we have something instead of nothing? We know that from nothing, nothing comes. There was a time when scientists believed in what is called the steady state theory. They replied that the universe was just always here. It didn't come from no place, it just happens to be here. But then, in the 1920s, the scientists started to discover that we are living in an expanding universe. In fact, when Einstein had worked out his theory of relativity, it was clear that an implication from that theory is that the universe is expanding. But you see, if the universe is expanding, it means it used to be smaller in the past, and we can retrace our steps till we get to something very small, maybe the size of a pea or a proton, even nothing. To avoid this sort of implication, Einstein introduced into his equations what he called the cosmological constant, to keep the universe from expanding. But the universe didn't obey Einstein and kept on expanding. In fact, the Quran makes allusion to this when the Quran says in Surah 51, verse number 47, وَالسَّمَاءَ بَنَيْنَاهَا بِأَيْدٍ وَإِنَّا لَمُوسِعُونَ. The heavens we have created with power, and we are expanding it. I understand that Dr. Atkins hadn't had an opportunity to study Islam, perhaps as I have, and so he was not aware that there was something to this effect in the Quran. I recall he said that there is no scripture which says that the universe is expanding, but here is one, folks. Now, the idea that the universe is expanding then leads us to think back in time to the origin of the universe, and that brings us back to the original question: where did everything come from? And this argues for the existence of a God who brought everything into being. Some will try to explain even that origin without needing to posit the existence of a God. And Dr. Atkins described this in his book entitled Creation Revisited, but he found himself in the later chapters of that book winding up in a self-contradiction. He has to talk about a time before time. He has to talk about space-time before space-time. And he has to talk about some mathematical points, because you have nothing in existence at the time, but you can posit mathematical points, which of course have neither length nor breadth. And you can talk about these swirling, and eventually we can have the universe as we do have now. But how did these points come into being? According to Dr. Atkins, you need time in order for the points to come into being. But you cannot have time without the points already having come into being. So he ends up saying that time brought the points into being, and the points brought time into being. Well, we can escape this contradiction by admitting the obvious, that there is a God who brought time and space into being. Second, I would like to argue for design in the universe as another proof for the existence of God. Dr. Atkins will agree that the universe has an appearance of having been designed. Scientists tell us now that at the origin of the universe, the four fundamental constants of physics must have been minutely fine-tuned in order for the universe to exist as it does. If, for example, let's take just one item, let's talk about the mass of the universe. If the density of mass was more or less, we would not have the universe that we have. So it appears that the exact amount was fine-tuned right from the beginning. Colin Rowan, in his book entitled The Universe, says that at Planck time, 10 to the minus 43, if the universe, the density of the universe differed than it was in more than one part in 10 to the minus 49, the universe would not have existed. So it appears that the exact amount was fine-tuned right from the beginning. So that argues for a fine-tuning and a God as the fine-tuner. Now, someone may reply, well, it has the appearance of being fine-tuned because here we are to observe it. If it wasn't fine-tuned, it wouldn't have existed and we wouldn't have been here to observe it. But this is just an apology given to avoid the implication that there is a God. Why? If I were to give you, let's take a mental experiment, I give each of you a dice, and I ask you to roll it, and it turns out to be six. Wherever you look around at your friends, you see everybody's got a six up. Now, you might initially conclude that these dice are fixed. But it would be a little bit far-fetched if you think, well, of course it turns up sixes, because this guy's been doing it all around the world, up and down the country. He's been having students rolling dice, and we just happened to be here on the one occasion when it came out right. It's a little bit far-fetched. More far-fetched even is to imagine there must be other public speakers like Shabir Ali turning around the world, and he's having lots of other university students rolling dices, and we happen to be the one group that happens to be with the speaker who gets it right. It doesn't seem to be the right way to go about it. It seems more likely that what we observe as fixed really is fixed, and for that you need someone to have fixed it. So we have here an argument for the existence of God. I'd like now to go to the second proposition and show that we actually need both science and religion, that they're not two competing ways of looking at the world, but two complementary ways. Stephen Jay Gould, in his recently published book entitled Rocks of the Ages, says that all human beings must pay at least rudimentary attention to both magisteria of religion and science. I should point out that Stephen Jay Gould is inclined towards atheism, and he's one of the most famous popularizers of evolution in modern times. Yet Stephen Jay Gould understands that science and religion are two complementary ways of looking at the world. And Gould cites, for example, some very important points. How can we answer ethical questions in science alone? We cannot. Science can tell us that bacteria, bugs, and us are made of the same stuff, but science cannot tell us that we are worth more than bugs or bacteria. Whether we are or are not, it is an ethical question that has to be answered not by science, but by religion. Now, Gould expressed his disgust with some of his colleagues, fellow scientists, who try to caricature religion, erecting religion as a straw man for rhetorical purposes, and they try to present science as though it is a panacea of human progress against that absurd caricature. And then he continues, he says, quote, if these colleagues wish to fight superstition, irrationalism, ignorance, dogma, and a host of other insults to the human intellect, then God bless them, but don't call this enemy religion. That's in pages 209 to 210 of his book. So we do need both science and religion. Can science alone suffice? No. Science cannot prescribe moral precepts. Science is capable of sending two astronauts out into outer space, but cannot prescribe for these astronauts that one should not rape or murder the other one. According to the hypothesis presented by Dr. Atkins, people just simply learned over time that it is more beneficial to be good to others. But if, according to that hypothesis, if one of these scientists, if one of these astronauts, decide that it is more beneficial to himself to be the lone colonizer of a distant planet, then it would be beneficial for him to rape and murder his opponent at will, and there would be no way for science to prescribe against that happening. The origin of human consciousness cannot be explained by science. Dr. Atkins himself admits that there is no explanation in science that can fully account for human consciousness. The origin of life cannot be fully accounted for. Some scientists who have tried to account for it found themselves presenting some very strange explanations. Francis Crick, for example, who shared the Nobel Prize in 1962 for his unraveling of the DNA double helix, in his book published 1981 entitled Life Itself, proposes that life must have got here upon Earth because some alien intelligence might have filled spaceships with spores and sent these spaceships out, computer controlled, to find planets like ours and drop their payloads. It sounds a little bit far-fetched and much simpler to believe in God creating life as it is. The origin of the universe cannot be fully explained by scientists. As Robert Jastrow says, it is not just simply a matter of another experiment or another decade of experiments. The way it looks now, science will never be able to probe the mystery of the origin of the universe. The laws of science break down and can only apply up to Planck time, which is 10 to the minus 43 seconds, but science cannot go beyond that as it appears at the moment. Will that happen in the future? If it does, we will gladly embrace the knowledge of how science explains that, but that would not displace belief in God, because science will explain the how of things happen, and our religion teaches us the who of how things happen. A pathologist can proceed with his job without asking the question about who. When a pathologist deals with a dead person, the pathologist only is concerned with how the death occurred, not with who caused that death. That has to be decided in a court of law. In a similar sense, science can explain the how of things, but not the who of things. Let me then talk a little bit about the tension and conflict between science and religion. Some religions are mythological. Scientists would not find this to be fitting for their understanding. Some religions prescribe unreasonable doctrines, asking you to believe things which you know do not add up. The scientists cannot accept that. Some religions prescribe beliefs and teachings which are shown to be non-scientific and unscientific. Science cannot accept that. And so the history of the conflict between religion and science is now entrenched in the minds of many who are familiar with many religions but haven't had the opportunity to learn more about Islam. For example, the tension between religion and science was heightened in the European Enlightenment period when scientists noticed a few points that were insisted upon in the religion that they were most familiar with. For example, the religion insisted upon geocentricity, that the earth is the center of the universe, and that had to be displaced. But we know that in order to displace that idea, some scientists had to struggle, and Galileo was imprisoned for the rest of his life, or placed under house arrest, for his belief that the earth is not the center of the universe. The usefulness of the earth. Some people propose that the earth is less than 10,000 years old, based on their understanding of a religious book. That religious book, folks, is not the glorious Quran, which does not prescribe the geocentricity of the earth, nor does it prescribe a young age for the earth. The fixity of the species is another thing that has been insisted upon in another religion, that in the European Enlightenment period had to be argued against. I do not find in the Quran anything that tells us that the species are fixed. The universality of the flood is another such idea, which in fact the Quran displaces. The Quran, studied carefully, shows that the flood of Noah was not a universal flood. But now let's talk about the possible harmony then between science and Islam in the remaining 2 minutes that I have. First, the Quran emphasizes learning and study. So the Quran is not counter science, but the Quran encourages science and growth. The discoveries in science will not displace religious faith, because again they're dealing with two different areas of human understanding. For this reason, we see that many early Muslim scientists excel in a number of areas. For example, Al-Khwarizmi wrote a book on algebra, and actually the word algebra comes from the title of his book, Al-Jabr. So the modern study of algebra, in fact, has roots in the origins in Islamic scholars doing their work. In his book entitled The Shape of the Earth, he left no one in doubt. Let me point out that Al-Khwarizmi died in the year 850, more than 1,100 years ago. 500 years before Galileo, a man by the name of Al-Biruni discussed the rotation of the earth. So there is no a conflict between religion and science. But can the Quran commend itself to modern scientists? Yes. In fact, Dr. Keith Moore, a scientist in Toronto, professor of embryology, whose textbooks are studied in universities throughout the Western world, having studied the Quranic statements on the growth and development of the human embryo, concluded that these statements could not have been discovered as truth prior to the discovery of the microscope. Only after the microscope could these things be studied, and he found the Quran to be amazingly accurate in the things that it said. And he finally concluded his study by saying, "I hope that the agreement I have found between the Quranic statements on the one hand and scientific discoveries on the other may help close the gap between science and religion, which has existed for so many years." So finally, I put before you folks four propositions. One, science does not support atheism, rather theism. Two, we need both science and religion. They're not in conflict, but should be in harmony. Three, the history of tension and conflict between science and religion involved not Islam, but other religions. And four, now we can see that there can be a harmony between Islam and science, and I commend to all of you Islam.
If I'd been able to interrupt, I would have interrupted at the end of most sentences and said, "I disagree with that." I think what we saw from Shabir Ali was a display typical of, if I may say, philosophers, that they are basically pessimists. They say, this cannot be done, this will not be done, this is inconceivable that this can be done. Whereas in fact, that should be seen in contrast to scientists who say, okay, we can't do it now, but let's go out and try to do it. And if you look at the history of science, you see that it has overcome the pessimism displayed by philosophers. The sight is that philosophers have to never learn to catch up every time that science shows that the pessimistic statement of a philosopher is in fact false. We're told that scientists will neither, neither, because it's more dramatic, understand or be able to explain human consciousness. Now, there's a huge amount of effort going on at the moment. I admit that it's a very difficult problem. There are two very difficult problems in the world of science. One is at the beginning, the origin of the universe. I agree that's really difficult, but we're getting ourselves equipped to deal with it. The other is at the other end, the emergence in this glorious creation of consciousness. And science has, because consciousness involves so many different aspects of science, it's only recently that scientists have started to turn their attention to it. There's no sign that we will not be able to elucidate consciousness. And to say that we cannot is and to say that it's just a sign of pessimism. It's also true of the origin of life. A difficult problem, no shortage of ideas, but we can't prove which of those ideas currently is correct. The origin of the universe, we're told that physical laws break down. Of at the Planck time. Of course they do. But we know the way ahead. We've got to combine general relativity and quantum theory. When we've done that, we can be pretty confident that we shall be at time zero. I believe in Occam's razor. And you will see that pervading my talk earlier this evening, I was really drawing upon Occam's razor by saying that if we can explain everything there is without drawing upon something else, then we should accept that the former is the more plausible explanation. I maintain that just about everything in the world can be
two.
Thank you. Just say two, I can't see from here. Everything in the world can be explained without invoking God, therefore God is in fact not necessary. I think it's wrong to say that we can't understand human behaviour scientifically, which I think was implied. The whole science of ethology is about the behaviour of organisms, and it is by extending the concept of organism to ourselves and looking at over our evolutionary history that we can see how we behave. It's ludicrous to say that an astronaut in a spacecraft won't kill the other person because of whatever it is. We're not talking about individuals, we're talking about the evolution of societies over thousands of years. Not just people trapped in a tiny little capsule somewhere. It's wrong to say that we cannot understand how something can come from nothing. In fact, if you were to look around and assess this universe, and I don't have time to go into the very subtle arguments that you touched on, and over summarized them, and I can correct you, but there are subtle arguments about the origin of the universe, something coming from nothing. My view would be that if you do the sum correctly, that is, if you, let's say, it's the simplified things, assess the total amount of energy in the universe, then the total amount of energy in the universe is in fact exactly zero. And so indeed nothing has come from nothing. And the amazing thing is that the nothing that surrounds us is so extraordinarily complex. Thank you.
In my opening presentation, I put before you four proposals which I argued for. One, that science does not support atheism, but rather it supports theism. It supports a belief in God. Now, Dr. Atkins has not been able to show how, in fact, science disproves the existence of God. And I think that proposal, therefore, stands. Dr. Atkins has argued for explanations for why people believe. And I've already shown in my opening presentation that showing why people came to this understanding is not necessarily a way of disproving it. You can show the reasons to be not good ones, but the thing believed might still be true. Dr. Atkins in his presentation said that science can explain aesthetics, why people perceive beauty, for example. But I think all that science can show is how beauty is perceived by individuals, but not why individuals appreciate beauty in the first place. Dr. Atkins thinks that religious belief can also be explained by science. But all we can do from a scientific inquiry is to explain how people respond to religious beliefs. We can put probes in their brains and see how they respond under different states of religious experience, for example. But to explain the history and origin of religious belief is something that science has not been able to fully elucidate. Neither has historians been able to fully elucidate that history. Some may say that when our ancestors came down from the trees, they felt helpless and they invented this idea of God. However, this is just a hope on the part of evolutionists or atheists. There is no proof or no evidence that when monkeys came down from trees or apes started walking in the savannas, that they felt helpless and hopeless. In fact, the evolutionary theory would point in the other direction, that they had good reason for coming out into the open. Now, Dr. Atkins pointed out that religion and science are similar in that they both search for truth. But he thinks that there is an important difference because science proceeds with public scrutiny, whereas religion proceeds on private sentimental wishful thinking. I think the difference, however, was more aptly put by a philosopher, Mortimer Adler. Mortimer Adler in The Great Ideas explained that there is a difference between science and philosophy. Science is inquisitive, but philosophy is reflective. There are things which cannot be answered by science, for example, as to what do we have to do to be good, why should we be good in the first place. This has to be explained by philosophy. So that requires reflection. It's a different area than science. You cannot discover by the scientific method why should you be good in the first place. But philosophy tries to answer that. However, philosophy cannot come to final answers, and religion fits that bill, because religion prescribes the final and absolute answers for these such questions. So, to put it in a nutshell, science is inquisitive, philosophy is reflective, but religion is receptive. In fact, Dr. Atkins presented religion as though it is just fit for ignoramuses. However, we realize that we learn information in more than one ways. We might make discoveries of ourselves. We might rely on discoveries of other people. We might, for example, rely on Dr. Atkins to teach us physical chemistry. Now, how do we receive the information from others? We might talk to Dr. Atkins directly, or we may not talk to him directly, but we may read his textbook and learn from that. So we can, in fact, learn information that is not immediately accessible to us by receiving a message through Dr. Atkins's book. Now, all we have to do is to make sure that the book really, in fact, comes from Dr. Atkins. And this is what we have tried to do in the religion of Islam, to scrutinize the Quran. Enemies have tried, believers have tried, to find out whether this book really is from God. And once we are satisfied that there are genuine reasons for believing the Quran to be the Word of God, then we have here a new way of learning opening up to us, in addition to science and in harmony with science. We need them both.
Question that I can find. The existence after death is not such a belief mathematically irrational. And I'm guessing that's directed to Shabir.
Well, I think perhaps Dr. Atkins might be more adept at dealing with the mathematics on this. However, one of Dr. Atkins's Oxford University colleagues, Professor Keith Ward, in his book God, Chance, and Necessity, and in one of his most recent books on the aspect or the prospect of religion in a scientific age, and even in another book on defending the soul, that is the title of the book, he has argued that there is something in human beings which is not yet fully understood by science, and that thing is consciousness. How consciousness came about and what happens to consciousness after death cannot be fully explicated by science, and it is possible that there is a consciousness which survives death. This I do not see how science can actually disprove. But now, we said that religion is also receptive, and we have information. If there is a God and if the Quran is his book, on both points which we are confident of, then there is a soul that the Quran tells us about that is there with human beings, and we can see that from a scientific point of view as well. There is something in human beings that is much different than animals. For example, the chimpanzee, which is said from the evolutionary point of view to be our closest relative, can think of how to perhaps place a chair in the right place to get to his banana, which is hanging overhead. But according to Colin Ronan in his book The Universe, this is the acme of problem solving in the chimpanzee. Whereas human beings, on the other hand, can think about thinking and can think about the whole question of problem solving on the whole. So human beings think on a much higher dimension. Human beings have a consciousness that permits them to have religious ideas. This, of course, is much different from the animal world. In fact, anthropologists have tried to answer whether or not what are called pre-humans might have had any form of religion. And the closest they have found is Neanderthal man being buried with flowers. But that does not give any conclusive evidence whether Neanderthal man really practiced religion and whether they had sacred rites at their burials. All we have is the evidence of flowers. But in any case, Neanderthal man is not said to be leading up to modern human beings, but now has thought to be a side branch of evolution leading away from the modern species of Homo sapiens. So in any case, we have it now that modern human beings are the only species that we know that practice religion. There is probably some reason for this, and the universal consciousness among human beings is that there is something which is bigger and greater than ourselves. This is why we find that in the world's major religions, there is some sense of an ultimate being, even in Buddhism, which denies or does not speak of the existence of God, does have this concept of a universal being with whom we must unify after having reached the stage of nirvana. So why this is so needs to be explained. It seems that for all of these reasons, it is better to say that there is a soul that survives after death, as the scripture confirms.
Consciousness is a physical phenomenon. It arises from physiological, chemical, biological, physical processes going on inside that enormously complex organ, the brain. As soon as the brain disintegrates, which it does on death, when it's no longer sustained by the input of metabolic processes, then the physical processes that we call consciousness decay as well. It's just simple wishful thinking that consciousness can survive the decay of the brain. Just like consciousness is put on a pedestal. I mean, it's nothing very special about consciousness. I mean, it's an amazing phenomenon, but it's not really very special. It is just a physical process going on inside the brain, which we don't yet fully understand. The soul is simply an extension of the idea that consciousness persists after death. So the soul, if you like, is just simple wishful thinking. I think the soul is the it makes philosophers' life worthwhile. They've invented it, building upon the fears of humans. So, of course we're more complex than chimpanzees. Of course we can have worries and things like that. We've got more cortex. I mean, that's what science says. Look inside your head. You've got more cortex. That's a much more complex signal processing can go on in there. And it's not surprising that some of that signal processing leads to error. And some of that error is poetry, and some of it is religion.
We are intellectually honest and understand the limitations of the scientific method. Science can only make verifiable conclusions of observable, tangible phenomena which can be subjected to experiment. Science, therefore, cannot prove or disprove God. If you understand God as a creator to be independent of creation and unlimited in time and space, can both speakers please comment?
Is it?
Yeah.
I agree with every word of that, surprisingly. If there isn't a God, then there's clearly nothing to study, which is one problem that science has with God. What more can one say? There might be a God. I don't believe there is one, and I think all the evidence points to there not being. But I certainly can't disprove mathematically, if you like, that there is one. All I can do is to assemble ideas and evidence around me to show that there is no need for a God. And I can assemble evidence to show why people long for there to be a God, and I can put those two together and conclude that there is in fact no God. But I can't actually prove that there isn't one.
If you recall my explanation of the what is commonly called the cosmological argument, the argument for the existence of God from the fact that we do have the cosmos, then if we go back to the Big Bang origin, then we're talking about the origin of the universe, and if there is a creator, that creator naturally is outside of the space-time continuum that we do observe. And so Dr. Atkins is right. There will be no way of disproving scientifically that such a God exists. And hence his conclusion that there might be a God is a valid one. Now, he thinks that there is not a God, and I think that there is a God, and he thinks that there might be a God. But on the other hand, if indeed Dr. Atkins is right and there is no God, Dr. Atkins, I'd like to give you my full assurance that in that case I would have nothing to worry about.
Within the talks were mentioned Kazakhstan, Japan, and Arabia. I have never seen any of these places. Why should I assume that they exist? Why should I believe in something that I haven't sensed?
I will try to slightly enlarge that. I think the point of science is that it's a network of interrelating, supportive, mutually supportive ideas. That's the amazing thing about science, that ideas flow into the corpus of knowledge that we call science from all manner of different directions, and where they mingle, they do not conflict, they are supportive. This is an amazing feature of science. So the fact that in order to understand the large-scale structure of the universe, we actually need to draw on material relating to fundamental particles, as it were, the other scale of being, really. But where the two ideas of the grandness of the universe and the microscopic structure of the universe mingle, they don't conflict. They turn out to be mutually supportive. So if I see something which conflicts with science as a whole, I am extremely suspicious of it. I am suspicious, for example, of anything supernatural. I don't believe that anything supernatural ever has occurred. I don't believe that any miracle has ever occurred, simply because it conflicts too much with the corpus, the whole fabric of science. But if something does fit in with this corpus of knowledge that we call science, I'm sympathetic to it, and I believe that it might well exist.
The question points to a very important point. We learn about things that we haven't observed by getting reports about the existence of such things, like countries, for example, like Kazakhstan. And so it would be a little bit rude to go through life saying, I'm not going to believe anything except what I observe myself. But now, is there a supernatural dimension? Is there a metaphysical world that we can know about apart from science? Can religion contribute to that understanding? Yes, in the similar sense that we receive information from other sources. We can receive information from the metaphysical world by reading the glorious Quran. Now the question is this Quran really that sort of information, or is it a construct of the human consciousness? When we examine the Quran, we see that it could not have come from the man who first pronounced it to the world. The Quran speaks to that man, addresses him, even criticizes him. The man himself was not capable of reading or writing. He couldn't have written a book, much less a book like the Quran. The man himself was sincere. He kept on preaching the message despite persecution. He refused offers. He died penniless. He refused power and wealth, so he had no motive for lying to the people. Moreover, he couldn't have lied to the people because the information contained in the Quran reflects some past history, and we see that to be accurate. Tells us about the future, and the future turns out exactly the way the Quran said that it would. The Quran describes physical phenomena which modern scientists find to be extremely amazing, and they realize that this information could not have come from the milieu or the time when the Quran was made available to the world. Moreover, the Quran challenges human beings to find errors in it, thus disproving it to be from God, and moreover, to produce a book like it to show that it is humanly possible to produce such a book. And today, no one can explain why no one has been able to produce a book like the Quran except to conclude that the Quran is a miracle and hence a message from God telling us that the subconscious does exist, that the world, the metaphysical world does exist, and God and the soul do exist.
There are a number of related questions here, so inshallah I'll try and put them all together. Professor Atkins mentions that humans learnt morals through the evolution of society over thousands of years, but during that time society all over the world was steeped in religion. Does he not think humans need a spiritual foundation for morals, i.e. some sort of religious belief? The second law of thermodynamics just leads to despair. Already religion has receded this century in Western culture, and accompanying that there is greater disillusionment in society. What can suitably replace religion as a believable moral guide for humans? As an addition to that, how does or can science instill ethics and morality into a human being and the concept of what is right and what is wrong?
These questions touch upon a very important point, the question of morals. Science is incapable of teaching morals. It is outside of the domain of science to do this. Now, that doesn't mean that scientists are amoral, or that they do not have morals of their own, or that scientists will not try to teach their own morals to others. When Dr. Atkins comes up here, he might want to tell you that we should not encroach upon the domain and the rights of others. Now, that's a very fine principle, but that principle doesn't come from science, it comes from philosophy and from religion. So it is outside the domain of science. You see, science can discover things, but cannot tell us how to use those things. When the man Nobel invented dynamite, he invented it for good purposes, for quarrying. But the same dynamite is used for taking lives. And to Nobel's shock and dismay, this is what happened. He had predicted that war would now become impossible after the invention of the dynamite, because nobody would want to use dynamite to their own self-destruction, perhaps. But Nobel was wrong. And when he found out how wrong he was, he donated a large sum of his wealth to establish the Peace Prize, among other things. When the Italian scientist Sobrero discovered gunpowder, he wanted to keep his invention secret. He didn't want the world to find out how to use gunpowder, but to his utter dismay, we're using it. And now we have nuclear weapons. Science can give us these things, but cannot tell us how to use them. Science can tell us how to construct an atomic bomb, but it is left to religion to tell us how to use these. Now, without religion, there is no absolute way of determining what is good and bad. You might say that, given the evolutionary perspective, what is good is what you have learned is beneficial for yourself. But then questions arise. What is beneficial for the individual over the community, or the community over the individual? If it is useful for me at the time, is it right to go ahead and rape, kill, and plunder? If it is beneficial to me, if I can find a way to get away with it, according to the utilitarian principle that would have to be adopted through the evolutionary thinking, is that if it is beneficial for you, there is no reason why you shouldn't do it. But religion says that no, it is absolutely wrong. It is what Kant called the categorical imperative. It is not wrong because it will be disadvantageous to you, or it is not good because it will be advantageous to you. It is either wrong because it is wrong, or it is right because it is right. And most of us think that certain things are definitely wrong, like the torturing of an innocent child just for fun. Where do we get this idea from that this is definitely wrong? It comes from a precept in religion that God already instilled in human beings this distinction between right and wrong.
Heaven protect us if we rely upon religion to tell us when to use weapons and not to use weapons. And we look at the history of the world and the wars that have been driven by religion, and indeed the wars that continue to be driven by religion. One is simply horrified at the thought that we are putting weapons into the hands of religious. My point, as I actually made in my presentation, was that science can teach us morality in the sense that we can understand human nature through science. We can understand the origins of our behaviour. It's far better to understand the origins of our animal behaviour, if you like, than to put our trust in a written authority compiled centuries ago. You can see how religion, how evolution might have generated a sense of morality. I'm not saying that this is a realistic model, but you could say, well, once upon a time there was a tribe who decided that that it was right to eat their children. Now, such a tribe thought it was right, but such a tribe would not persist, quite clearly, that it would be dead and extinct within a generation or so. And so ingrained into the tribes that actually do persist and have survived to the present day is a sense that, okay, maybe we shouldn't eat our children, and to a lesser extent torture our children. So that's the way that we should look at ourselves, to see how behaviour has emerged through the ability of tribes and to survive. We also have this extraordinary ability that is possessed by no other organism to reflect upon the consequences of our actions, and that is the major component of our morality. We can see that it's best not to stab our neighbours in the back because they might stab us, and so there is a kind of if you like a Darwinian form of behaviour. I think that's all I need to say on that.
The next question is, what science is there in the Quran? Sorry.
Well, the Quran is a remarkable book in that it was revealed in the 7th century, and yet it also speaks to 20th century man. It is revealed in language which is accessible to people who were the initial recipients, and yet the same language speaks to modern human beings. For example, the Quran talks about the heavens when it was smoke. And today, the same word smoke is understood as a gaseous mass, and modern scientists, like for example the French scientist Dr. Maurice Bouquet, explains that the same Arabic word dukhan, which means a smoke, and one can imagine a hazy appearance of the early universe, means to a modern scientist a gaseous mass, and it gels with the modern cosmology. In a similar sense, the Quran talks about a time when the heavens and the earth were one piece before God split them asunder. And again, that's a very simple way of putting it, is understood by modern scientists to be in agreement with their modern cosmology, that there was a time when the heavens were smoke and a time when the heavens and earth were altogether one before God separated them. The Quran speaks about the shape of the earth, not directly, but in every clue seems to be pointing in that direction. For example, the Quran talks about the day and night coiling around the earth, and the verb used for coiling is the same verb that is used for a man coiling his turban around his head, and you can imagine the head and the turban going around. Imagine the earth and the day and night going around the world, and this is precisely what happens. In fact, the word yukawir in Arabic, which is used to describe this action, is the same word from which we derive the word kura, which means ball, in the Arabic language. No wonder early Muslim scientists already were studying the world by looking at globes, whereas in the Dark Ages in Europe, people still thought that the Earth was flat. This led Houston Smith, in his book, The World's Religions, to admit that the modern scientists owe a lot of debt to the science that was developed by early Muslim scientists. So I've already touched upon embryology. There are a number of areas in the Quran which touches upon physical descriptions of a remarkably accurate nature, showing that there is information in the Quran which could not have been known to human beings prior to modern times. So that leads us to answer, where really did the Quran come from? Could it really have come from the subconscious mind of an individual who lived 1400 years ago? I think it cannot.
I think all holy books are written in such vague language that they are open to any interpretation. It's only when science has progressed to the point that it has made a statement of about the world that the interpreters go back and say, oh yes, this can mean that. Smoke, I mean, it's quite understandable that early man would have thought of it as smoke. It's when the physicists have got to work, they say, well, what they must really have meant was that it was whatever it currently is thought to be by the physicists. So holy books are vaguely written, and the reason that they survive is that they are so vague that they are open to interpretation according to the tenets of contemporary science. I'm not surprised that the writers of the Quran thought that the earth was round. After all, the Greeks knew that it was round. They'd actually measured its radius long before the Quran was written. And so it's not at all surprising that that kind of information got into it. I'm not at all impressed if that is the kind of evidence that shows that, in fact, the Quran was written as under the guidance of God. It was probably written under the guidance of the Greeks.
I think these two are kind of related. Science, particularly chemistry, is based upon entities which are impossible to prove directly. For example, protons and molecules. Why then does Peter Atkins have such difficulty in accepting a phenomenon such as God?
Oh dear, well, I think we've gone through this. You can actually see molecules, of course, so chemistry is not based on entities that you can't see, provided that you, by seeing, you mean using instrumental techniques to display images of the entities. Plenty of images of molecules now survive. We can know that protons exist in a certain sense because we can, in a more abstract sense, see them in scattering experiments and so on. We've got no particular problems with that. They are entities that science requires in order to account for its observations. The idea of God is entirely different. It's entirely an invention for which there is no experimental evidence, there is no observational evidence, and indeed everything that happens in the world can be explained without it. If I found that I could explain the whole of chemistry without invoking a molecule, then I would have no belief in molecules. Exactly the same applies to, in my view, to belief in God.
Of course, there are many things that we conclude without having direct evidence for the things. For example, that electrons exist. We know that they do from the effects, and Dr. Atkins is quite right. We have to posit the existence of certain things based on the effects that we do observe. The observations themselves require the existence of certain entities. In a similar sense, the nature of the world, the fine-tuning of the world, the fact that the world is here, and the fact that moral judgment does exist, that there is an absolute moral value that we know about, the fact that we experience God when we speak to Him in our prayer, when we observe our fasting, when we make Hajj, the fact that And the Quran is here. All of this require that God does exist. The fact of the Quran, for example, cannot be explained by citing ancient Greek learning in science, unless we can show how that learning passed on from the Greeks to the Arabs in the time when the Quran was written. On the contrary, scientists who have had a chance to study the Quran, which Dr. Atkins admitted he didn't have a chance to do, have concluded that this information could not have come from the time in which it was written, and they have openly said it must be a revelation from God, although they themselves have not admitted belief in the religion of Islam. So we have reasons for positing the existence of God, not within science, but in addition to science.
Can I take up a point that really hasn't been discussed so far, which is the fine-tuning argument that you alluded to a moment ago, and indeed alluded to earlier in your talk. There are explanations of why it seems that the world is finely tuned. I mean, one is that it is indeed an accident, and the consequences of the universe tumbling into existence with the particular mix of fundamental constants that it has led to consciousness. We can't rule out the fact that it was a lucky accident. You can't, a priori, you can't rule it out. The other possibility, and indeed this possibility is supported by modern cosmological theories, is that this is not the only universe. That there are not just a few more universes, that there are billions, perhaps trillions, perhaps an infinite number of other universes. If each of those simply tumbled into existence with a, if you like, a random mix of fundamental constants, then it's not surprising that one of them has a particular mix that allows the emergence in it of consciousness. Now, it's much simpler to think of an infinite number of random universes just tumbling into existence than it is to think of one universe carefully designed by a creator. What science shows in this way is that you really have to be circumspect. You can't just take the easy option of looking around you saying, here's the universe, seems to be finely tuned, there must be a tuner. What you have to do is to think whether there is a simpler explanation that does not require a creator behind it. And that is the circumspection that is so important in science.
Now, if you'll allow me, I'll just respond to that very quickly. Folks, if you think back to my earlier example of rolling the dice, what happens is that when we notice that things appear to be fine-tuned, we take that as the logical explanation unless we are committed to some other belief. For example, if I give each of you a dice and I ask you to roll that and each one turns up six, you find this to be improbable. It shouldn't happen. Why did it happen on this one occasion? So you're wondering, wouldn't you just think that perhaps the dice are fixed? I just gave you dice which will naturally turn up six. But it will be a little bit far-fetched to think that, well, you know, Shabir has been doing this up and down the country all over the world, and this is just the one lucky day. We happen to be in his lecture, and he got it right this time. He gave us dice, and we happen to roll them sixes. This is a little bit far-fetched to think that we happen to be in the one room where it turns out right. Or you might think that there are many other speakers doing the same thing and they're getting it all wrong, and you just happen to be in the one room with the one speaker who gets it right. Now, Dr. Atkins says that there might be parallel universes, there might be multiple universes. So in the other universes we have different forms of existence, and we see everything here fine-tuned, appearing the way it is, because we happen to be conscious to be able to observe it. If we weren't here, we wouldn't observe it. You know, suppose you were convicted to death by a firing squad for a crime that you didn't commit. Now imagine yourself, you're there before a 100-man firing squad of sharpshooters, and the guns go off, you fall unconscious, and then you wake up, and you realize you were only unconscious because of the shock of the moment, but these guys all missed. Now you might conclude that you have a friend on the other side. The fact that we are here and we are alive gives us reason to think that we do have a friend on the other side. In order to dispute this, one has to show that the dice are not fixed. So one has to examine the dice and see that they're not fixed, but you might conclude that they are fixed, and you might want to examine the dice to see if indeed they are fixed. And when you find that they are fixed, you will conclude that there is a fixer. Now, Dr. Atkins and other scientists have found that the universe does have the appearance of being fine-tuned. Dr. Atkins admits this. But because of his prior commitment to atheism, he would not admit, as a good possibility, that there does exist a fine-tuner.
To Dr. Atkins, what is the point of our existence?
I think you have to answer this at two levels. One is the cosmic purpose, and one is the personal purpose. The cosmic purpose, there isn't a cosmic purpose. There is no reason for, there's no teleological reason for the universe existing as far as I can see. It's in a sense a lucky accident. There is no purpose, despite the fact that theologians like to invent purposes for it. So on the cosmic scale, there is no purpose. Indeed, if you look into the distant future, when the universe has stretched out to infinity and so on, there will be no matter left, and indeed no radiation, and all there will be dead flat space-time. So, in due course, all our achievements will be as nothing. So, cosmically, there is no purpose. Privately, personally, of course, there's a great deal of purpose. My purpose coming here this evening is, I don't know what my purpose was, basically to have fun, I suppose. Try to convert you, as I said, but, you know, I have sort of forlorn hope. My purpose is to enjoy life. My purpose is to take full advantage of the lucky accident that I am alive and will be alive, have been alive for whatever many years it is, hope to be alive for longer, have this wonderful gift, don't misconstrue the word gift, have this wonderful gift of being conscious in this amazing, delightful, glorious, complex world. I don't want to waste it. And if it means sort of exercising my brain by coming here this evening and trying to argue in front of you, if it means going to a restaurant and enjoying a good meal, whatever, then I intend to do that. It's a glorious opportunity to take pleasure from being alive. That's the personal purpose of life. But taking that glorious purpose should not thwart the aspirations of all the other people in the world who have an equal opportunity, equal aspirations to enjoy their one chance of life in the same way. That, if you like, is the germ of my morality.
Again, purpose is one of those things which science cannot really deal with. Science can explain how an invention works, but not for what purpose it was made. Someone might have made an invention for one purpose, and scientists can discover the purposes, but not because of doing science. Science will explain how the thing was made and how it works, but not why it was made in the first place. Now, Dr. Atkins looks at the things that we do and the moments of purpose that we apply to our actions. But the question really is, why are we here in the first place? Why does the universe exist? And how did life originate in the universe? For what purpose? Scientists cannot still explain with any clarity and conviction how life originated upon Earth. Cannot explain fully what consciousness is. Dr. Atkins himself says no one comprehends what consciousness really is, and then he concludes saying something about our inability to comprehend comprehension. So if we cannot understand why life is here, or how it even came to be here, how can we discover why it is here? If we cannot yet explain what consciousness is, how can we even discover why we have it in the first place? The question of why is a different question that can only be answered by the attempts of philosophers and by the conclusive message that comes through religion, in particular the religion of Islam.
Most of the questions of religion are like Bertrand Russell's teapot. Bertrand Russell proposed that there is a teapot in orbit around Mars. And then, of course, a great deal of effort would be spent. You couldn't actually disprove that there was not, that there was a teapot in orbit around Mars. Purpose is actually a teapot. The theologians propose that there is a purpose and then ask scientists to prove that there isn't one. I mean, it's an entirely invented question. There is no such thing as purpose. It's just a theological invention. But let me take up what I think is the really deep question that Shavari Ali touched on a moment at the start of your response a moment ago. And I'll be provocative here, because I don't think I've been provocative throughout the evening. I think there is actually no such question as why. In my view, and I think this is really the crucial point, and it's really been lurking behind our comments on both our sides throughout the evening. And I think, if we had our time over again, which you may, but I think I will not, I think I would concentrate on the following. I think that every why question has to be deconstructed into a chain of how questions. So why are we here? It's not really a question, it's a kind of bundle of questions. It's like we have to say, how did we come to be here, is what we're really saying when we say why. And I think it's by focusing on how that we will actually understand our nature and indeed all the great questions of being that have touched on this evening.
So I think we'll wrap it up there, but I'd like to thank both Professor Peter Atkins and Shavari Ali.
2 minutes.
Yeah. 2 minutes for conclusion.
Well, okay, 2 minutes. I've been concluding all the time anyway. I'm a simpleton, in the sense that I believe that simple explanations are better than complex explanations. I would like to explore, even though it takes an enormous amount of hard work, whether the simplest conceivable explanation of something is adequate. If it is adequate, then I will accept it as being correct. Now, I don't believe that the statement, God did it, is a simple statement. It's actually a very, very complex statement, heavily disguised, because it's got all the paraphernalia of what a God is and all that sort of thing, and how he could have brought the world into being. What I want to do, green science can't do it yet, but I believe it is the central aim of science, if you like, the heart of science, is to look for the extraordinarily simple explanation of the extraordinarily complex phenomena that pervade this universe. It takes enormous intellectual effort to do that, but it is the scientific method that seems to be on the track of achieving that goal.
Now, folks, I've argued tonight for 4 propositions. One, that science does not support atheism, but rather theism, and I've given some good arguments to show that science supports belief in a God and does not provide any disproof of that. Two, I've shown that we need both science and religion. They are, as Stephen Jay Gould has said, 2 different magisteria, 2 teaching authorities, and every human being must pay at least rudimentary effort to understanding both. Third, I've shown that the history of the tension and conflict between religion and science did not involve Islam but another religion. And four, I've argued for the harmony between science and religion, showing that it is possible for modern scientists to appreciate Islam. I mentioned previously Dr. Keith Moore. I'd like to also mention Dr. TVN Prasad, professor of anatomy and the head of the Department of Anatomy and professor of pediatrics at the University of Manitoba in Winnipeg. He concluded also that the Quran must be a revelation. Dr. Jolie Simpson from the United States in Texas, in the College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. I would also like to mention Dr. Marshall Johnson. He's professor and chairman of the Department of Anatomy at his university, the Daniel Bo Institute, Thomas Jefferson, and so on. But finally, I'd like to mention Dr. Tejata Tejasan from the University of Chiang Mai in Thailand. At a conference discussing the correlation between science and the Quran, he became moved eventually to stand up and say that having seen all of this, it is time for me to say there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. I'd like to invite all of you to do the same in the light of the evidence provided tonight.